Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have details for you on San Diego County's return to the red tier as COVID-19 restrictions are eased by the state, allowing many businesses to reopen with capacity limits. And then on Tribal Beat, we'll have details on the historic confirmation of Deb Haaland as Secretary of the Interior, the first Native American to head a cabinet agency. From California News Service, we'll then have a report on efforts by Care for All to expand affordable health care options for Californians. We'll also have a special report today on a win for foster youths after supervisors unanimously voted to ask the state to keep the San Pasqual Academy for Foster Youths open. An El Cajon musician with no arms, Mark Gaffney, known as Big Toe, has died after gaining worldwide fame and inspiring people with disabilities around the world by learning to play instruments with his feet. From California News Service, hear about efforts to improve equity in distance learning. SDG&E has won an appeal to the California Public Utilities Commission to grant rate relief to some consumers by eliminating high usage rates in the near future. From Public News Service, we'll have national news stories, including congressional actions on immigration reforms, efforts to reopen nursing homes for family visits, and renewal of the Violence Against Women Act, which includes closing a loophole that impacts gun owners in domestic violence cases. On 2021 Talk, we'll have information on a vaccine milestone reached this week in the U.S., efforts to stop hate crimes against Asian Americans, a new migrant children crisis at the border, and confirmation of key Biden appointees, including California's own Javier Becerra as head of Health and Human Services. And finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with former San Diego Union-Tribune journalist and historian Roger Scholey on his new book about San Diego's history. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
San Diego County moved from the purple tier into the less restrictive red tier this week due to improvements in the COVID-19 outlook locally. This allows many businesses to reopen or expand capacity, though masks and social distancing are still required. Here are some of the changes. Movie theaters can show indoor films at 25% capacity or 100 people, whichever is less. Restaurants can operate indoors at 25% capacity. Gym and fitness centers can open indoors at 10% capacity. Museums, zoos, and aquariums can open indoors at 25% capacity, and retail and shopping centers can operate indoors at 50% capacity. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says, "It's because of the efforts of our community that the county is able to move back into the red tier after 4 months of purple tier restrictions." But Dr. Wooten urges San Diegans not to let their guard down, adding, "We are urging community members to continue to do their part, get vaccinated once they are eligible, and take the necessary precautions to avoid getting and spreading COVID-19. The county must stay in the red tier and post 2 consecutive weeks of qualifying data to move into the less restrictive orange tier. The positive testing rate is now just 2.8%, the lowest in several months. San Diego is also doing well in administering vaccines in communities with the highest rate of COVID, a factor measured by the state health equity rate. But case rates need to drop to move into the even less restrictive orange tier. A key reason for the improved COVID numbers is the vaccine rollout. Nearly 17% of eligible San Diegans aged 16 and older are now fully vaccinated. More easing of restrictions, including allowing live sports with limited audiences. Starting April 1st, the Padres will be allowed to reopen Petco Park for live audiences at 20% capacity, finally giving fans something to cheer about. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Mitchell Murphy.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
This is Jonathan Getz with East County Magazine's Tribal Beat. By a 51-40 vote, the U.S. Senate has confirmed Deb Haaland to serve as Secretary of the U.S. Department of the Interior, the first Native American to lead a federal cabinet agency. Four Republican senators joined with Democrats to support the nomination of Haaland, an enrolled member of the Pueblo of Laguna tribe, who also has Jemez Pueblo heritage. Her appointment by President Joe Biden has been hailed by Native American leaders and environmentalists nationwide. The agency oversees the National Park Service, National Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, Bureau of Indian Education, Office of the Inspector General, Bureau of Reclamation, and more. In her confirmation before the Senate Energy Committee, Haaland testified, "If an indigenous woman from humble beginnings can be confirmed as Secretary of the Interior, our country and its promise still holds true for everyone." Haaland has served in the U.S. House of Representatives since 2018, representing New Mexico, one of only two Native Americans in Congress. She grew up in a military family. Her father was a combat Marine veteran, and her mother is a Navy veteran, who also worked for 25 years in Indian education. As a single mother, Haaland relied on food stamps at times and struggled to put herself through college, earning a law degree from the University of New Mexico. She also ran her own small business, producing and canning Pueblo salsa. In addition, she chaired the Laguna Development Corporation Board of Directors, overseeing tribal gaming, where she advocated supporting earth-friendly business practices. She is also a former tribal administrator. She became the first Native American woman to lead a state political party and traveled to Standing Rock, showing solidarity with tribal members trying to protect sovereignty and natural resources. She has promised to support tribal consultation, inclusivity, and collaboration as Secretary of the Interior, an agency that employs 70,000 people and oversees one-fifth of the nation's land, also carrying out the U.S. government's trust responsibilities with regard to tribal nations. Haaland's nomination was supported by the National Congress of American Indians and by hundreds of tribal leaders who sent letters to senators in support of her confirmation. The American Wild Horse Campaign's executive director, Suzanne Roy, also praised Haaland's nomination. In a press release, Roy states, "We applaud the historic confirmation of Secretary Haaland and look forward to her inspired leadership in the fight to protect America's public lands and the wildlife, including the wild horses and burros." Deb Haaland's appointment is big news in San Diego County, which has 19 Native American tribes and 18 tribal reservations, the most of any county in America. Erica Pinto, chair of the Jamul Indian Village in San Diego's East County, praised Haaland as an exceptional choice in an interview with East County Magazine recently, adding, "I think all of Indian country will agree with me." The Jamul tribal leader believes Haaland understands the challenges faced by Native Americans over land preservation, and that she has pledged to plant 30 million new trees. Pinto concludes she cares about the environment.
Welcome to East County Magazine Show's Jobs Talk, bringing you news about great jobs, job training opportunities, and growing our regional economy. San Diego County's Board of Supervisors voted 5-0 this week in support of the Youth Environmental Recreation Corps, a program aimed to provide youth with skills training and opportunities to gain work experience in the growing sector of green economies. The county staff will have 90 days to report back to supervisors with a fully detailed plan to provide green jobs for our region's young people. The program will be open to San Diego County residents ages 16 to 24. Youth Will has been working closely with Supervisor Lawson Reamer and the Invest in San Diego Families Coalition to promote this initiative and ensure the youth voice is represented in improving access to green space and green work opportunities. Supervisors Tara Lawson-Reamer and Nora Vargas proposed the Corps to support career readiness, workforce development, and mentorship. The program will provide paid employment opportunities for low-income youths through county departments, with a focus on careers in the green economy. Supervisor Lawson-Reamer says mentors helped me flourish as a young person, but if I were growing up in isolation during a global pandemic, I don't know if I would be so lucky. At a time when opportunity and social interaction has disappeared for many students and entry-level workers, this youth corps will help young people jumpstart their careers with paid positions to help them get a foothold in the green economy. Sophia Haidara, youth organizer at YouthWill, praised the decision. She says, youth is our future, and in order to have a growing, vibrant, and sustainable San Diego, we must invest in their opportunities. The Youth Environmental Recreation Corps will not only invest in their future, but prioritize the youth of today who are still suffering from COVID-19 impacts, social isolation, job losses, health impacts, and more. But, she adds, our work doesn't stop here. We will continue to open equitable pathways to ensure all young people who want to work have work. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Care for All California Coalition, made up of some 60 nonprofit advocacy groups, is pressing for passage of a package of 10 proposals designed to give more people access to health care and make the system more equitable for Californians of all races. The best known is Assembly Bill 4, which would extend Medi-Cal to all income-eligible Californians, regardless of immigration status, and Senate Bill 56, which would cover undocumented seniors. Anthony Wright with the nonprofit Health Access says the bills would get a lot more people covered.
California could again cut the rate of the uninsured in half to get under 5% and near universal coverage. California can continue to lead on coverage, on holding the health industry accountable for reducing disparities, and on quality and cost.
Another bill in the package, Senate Bill 644, would allow the state insurance exchange, known as Covered California, to send an email about health plans and subsidies to anyone who applies for unemployment. And Senate Bill 65 would cover doula and midwife services under Medi-Cal in an effort to reduce the number of women and babies, particularly people of color, who die in childbirth. Assemblymember Wendy Carrillo notes that during the pandemic, a lot of people suddenly lost their jobs and health insurance and couldn't qualify for Medi-Cal because they own a home, have more than one car per driver, or had a month's worth of savings in the bank.
This means that low-income and no-income Californians must pay for doctor's visits, prescription drugs, x-rays, and even surgeries and hospital stays until they are completely destitute. And then, and only then, are they allowed to get Medi-Cal.
Korea's new bill, AB 470, would eliminate the asset test for Medi-Cal eligibility. Other proposals would create a state office of healthcare affordability and strengthen oversight on consolidation in the healthcare industry, which its backers say contributes to higher costs for patients. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
In a win for foster youths, San Diego County supervisors have voted unanimously this week to approve a motion asking state officials to grant a reprieve to the San Pasquale Academy, a model boarding school for foster youths that was slated to close later this year. The school in Escondido has been a safe haven for foster youths from across the county who found a home at the academy when they were unable to be placed with families as they aged out of the system. The facility was opened in 2015 as a pilot program approved by the state for foster youths up to age 21, but the academy was slated to close in December after the state phased out board and care facilities, and then the state stepped up the timeline to October, a closure that would have left 70 foster youths at the facility without a home or a school amid a pandemic. Now it will be up to the state to decide. Supervisor Jim Desmond, the only supervisor to visit the facility, made a motion to request an extension from California state officials to keep the academy open through at least June of 2022 next year. The motion also asks the county to work with foster youths and stakeholders to do an analysis on options that could keep the academy open beyond 2022, with a potential carve-out in state and federal legislation. Reverend Shane Harris, president of the People's Association of Justice Advocates, has led efforts to keep the school open. Harris is an alumni of San Pasquale Academy, which he credits with helping him develop leadership skills after years in foster care himself. The national civil rights leader rallied public support, urging supervisors and the governor to take action to protect these vulnerable foster youths. He held press conferences and launched an online petition that drew hundreds of signatures. After the hearing this week, Harris thanked supervisors for the unanimous support of the motion, and in a press conference, he spoke about his own experience at the San Pasquale Academy and why it's important to keep the nation's first residential educational campus for foster youths open while working to make the system even better.
Of course, the first goal is to get youth to stay within their families. But if that can't happen, we need to provide a system that is more equitable and more fair and more just to the youth who are in the system. And the only way that that can be done is by continuing to reimagine what the foster care system looks like by investing in equitable resources to all of the youth in our system.
Harris hopes this incident will be a catalyst for revamping the foster care system, and he wants to see San Pasqual Academy stay open indefinitely. He pledged to take the fight next to the state and federal levels to reform the laws governing foster youth care and education. And he concludes,
"Of course, the first goal is to get youth to stay within their families. But if that can't happen, we need to provide a system that is more equitable and more fair and more just to the youth who are in the system. And the only way that that can be done is by continuing to reimagine what the foster care system looks like by investing in equitable resources to all of the youth in our system."
Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Mark Goffney, the internationally acclaimed armless musician known as Big Toe, who inspired people around the world, was found dead earlier this month in his El Cajon apartment, along with his wife, Anne Marie. Both were 51 years old. An autopsy will determine their causes of death. Born without arms in 1969, Goffney inspired millions with his can-do attitude. He'd learned to play the guitar and bass with his feet, strumming with his left foot and forming chords with his right. He was nominated for an Emmy Award in 1999 for his role in a Fox commercial titled Feet, which later aired during the Super Bowl. He's performed around the world with many top celebrities, also appearing on an array of TV shows, including The Regis Philbin and Mike Douglas shows. His fame began at age 4 when he became a poster child for the March of Dimes. He co-hosted dozens of telethons, along with celebrities such as Monty Hall and Kathy Lee Gifford, raising millions of dollars for charities to benefit children. His musical aspirations began as a child. He first played trombone in a school band. At age 9, his father brought home a guitar. He learned to play guitar, bass, and later in life, the harmonica, with a specially adapted holder. Of adding harmonica music to his repertoire, he said, "As a musician, I'm always looking to up my game. That haunting sound literally gives me goosebumps." In the late 90s, he cut a CD titled Big Toe, featuring his own original songs. It was named among the best of the best by the San Diego Reader. For the CD, he worked with Steve Dudas, former producer of rock stars Ringo Starr, Aerosmith, and Ozzy Osbourne. In East County, he attended Grossmont College, married, and had 3 children. Goffney formed a band, Big Toe, that has performed on the Fox TV program The Next Great American Band, created by Simon Cowell of American Idol, and on NBC.com's Star Tomorrow show. Goffney has since appeared in concerts around the world. He enjoyed entertaining others. Locally, you may have seen him performing in Balboa Park during the COVID-19 pandemic. You can hear his music and see videos at his website, Big Toe. Though Goffney has passed on, his legacy lives on, inspiring people everywhere to overcome disabilities and reach for the stars. His Big Toe bandmate, James Neal, posted this message on Facebook after learning of Goffney's passing. "I would like to thank everyone who supported Big Toe and wish his family well in this sad time," he wrote, calling Goffney a great musician and friend. He concludes, "God bless you, Mark. Keep rocking in heaven." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
San Diego Gas and Electric customers will no longer have to worry about getting hit with the state-mandated high usage charge, a substantially higher rate for electricity that kicks in for customers once their energy uses exceeds a certain threshold. Earlier this month, the California Public Utilities Commission voted to eliminate the high usage charge originally established by the state to encourage energy conservation. The decision comes 2 years after SDG&E filed an application with the PUC to remove the charge, which caused tens of thousands of customers' bills to spike during hot summer months when air conditioning is used. SDG&E's Chief Customer Officer Scott Kreider says, "We heard from our customers loud and clear that they felt strongly the high usage charge was punitive and unfair, particularly for those who live in hotter climate zones and by necessity use more energy for cooling during summer months. By eliminating the charge, our customers have one less thing to worry about during these difficult times and can get some relief." The high usage charge is expected to be removed before summer. The charge applies to about 312,000 customers on traditionally tiered pricing plans, which charges customers solely based on how much energy they use, not when they use it. Last year, about 25,000 SDG&E customers were impacted by the high usage charge. Customers on time-of-use pricing plans, for the vast majority of SDG&E's customer base, are not subject to the high usage charge, which applies during peak hours from 4 to 9 p.m. when the cost of electricity is the highest. The high usage charge dates back to 2017, per state requirements to encourage energy conservation. Residential customers incur the charge after they use 400% or more of their baseline allowance. Now, SDG&E did make two earlier requests to eliminate the high usage charge, but the state denied that. But now, the Public Utility Commission has determined that the charge was failing in its original purpose to get high usage customers to conserve electricity, since people still need air conditioning in very hot weather in areas such as East County's desert and mountain areas. The pandemic has made it even harder to cut usage during peak hours due to many people working from home and students using the internet for remote school instruction. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This week, millions of California kids will step into classrooms for the first time since the pandemic started a year ago. Even so, advocates for public education say the state can't let the quality of distance learning deteriorate. A large number of families are choosing to delay their children's return to in-person classes. Jaya Peterson-Lent with the nonprofit Generations United says that's especially true of multi-generational families where grandparents are the caregivers.
They may have real fear that if they were to get COVID-19 and be unable to continue to care for the child, that there isn't a backup plan for that child. So they're big decisions. They're difficult decisions.
Many see support for distance learning as an equity issue. Pew Research Center data show the highest share of multi-generational households are Asian and Latino families at 29 and 27% respectively. The publication Business Insider looked at census data and found California has more than 750,000 multi-generational households. That's the second highest share in the country at 5.77%. E. Toby Boyd, president of the California Teachers Association, predicts the new stimulus package signed by President Joe Biden last week will help school districts optimize distance learning.
Well, it's going to assist in making sure that the connectivity, the equipment, is going to be there. So it's going to take a while to build up. But with the resources now, they're going to have that opportunity to make sure it's occurring.
A survey done last fall in the LA Times showed a huge gap between rich and poor areas in terms of students' abilities to thrive during distance learning. So school districts have made a big push to issue free laptops and Wi-Fi devices to needy families. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for March the 19th, 2021. I'm Mike Clifford. Ohio's roughly 4,400 dreamers have stepped closer to the chance to become an American citizen. More from our Mary Sherman.
The U.S. House approved the American Dream and Promise Act last night, which creates a process for undocumented immigrants brought into the country as children to become U.S. citizens. And it expedites the process for deferred action for childhood arrivals recipients by providing eligibility for green card status. As immigration program manager at the Intercommunity Justice and Peace Center in Cincinnati, Samantha Searles calls it a historic day.
DACA recipients have grown up in American society and know the United States as their only home. These are real bright young people in our communities that will see an immediate impact.
There are more than 2.3 million dreamers living in the United States. The proposal also would extend a path to citizenship for those with temporary protected status. The House on Thursday also approved the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, which also provides a process for the millions of immigrant workers to establish permanent U.S. residency. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gunn Foundation.
A recent Quinnipiac poll found 65% of Americans support giving young undocumented immigrants a path to citizenship. Advocates for people with disabilities say the cap New York put on Medicaid spending in 2011 doesn't keep pace with growing health care needs, and they're urging lawmakers to finally repeal it.
Governor Andrew Cuomo's 2021-22 budget proposal calls for extending the Medicaid cap for two more years. But according to Heidi Siegfried with the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York, the cap is arbitrary, unrelated to growth in Medicaid enrollment, and unresponsive to medical needs.
It's really affected people with disabilities who rely on long-term home care in particular to stay out of nursing facilities and to get the services they need to remain in their home.
She says lawmakers in both the State Assembly and Senate have introduced legislation to repeal the global Medicaid cap. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
Families are returning to visit relatives at nursing homes in states like Pennsylvania, bringing a year of painful isolation to an end for many seniors. To Bill Johnston Walsh, the state director of AARP Pennsylvania, that's welcome news. Since isolation can cause depression, physical and mental decline among nursing home residents.
We believe that there's no substitute for the person to have in-person contact and a warm embrace that is so critical to the physical and mental well-being of nursing home residents.
Governor Tom Wolf's office is strongly encouraging all nursing home and long-term care facilities in the state to follow federal recommendations to expand visitation. This is PNS. A new part of the Violence Against Women Act passed in the U.S. House Wednesday would close a loophole that has allowed people accused of domestic abuse to buy guns during the time period when a court is considering making a temporary restraining order permanent.
The Lori Jackson Domestic Violence Survivor Protection Act is named after a Connecticut woman shot and killed in 2014 by her estranged husband. He was able to legally get a firearm despite a temporary restraining order. Liza Andrews with the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence says state law already includes extra protections for victims. She thinks it needs to expand nationwide.
I just think the will of federally elected officials to understand that domestic violence victims need protection right away and understanding that that initial moment of leaving is the most dangerous time.
This is Mike Clifford, and thank you for wrapping up your week with Public News Service member and listener supported, heard on radio stations big and small, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'm proud to announce that 58 days into our administration, we will have met my goal of ministering 100 million shots to our fellow Americans.
President Joe Biden says today the U.S. will pass the 100 million shot mark for COVID vaccine distribution, weeks ahead of schedule. An increasing number of states are expanding eligibility, including Colorado, Ohio, Massachusetts, Michigan, Montana, and Utah. Meanwhile, the president is traveling today to Atlanta with Vice President Kamala Harris to meet with Asian American leaders in the wake of a shooter who killed at least 8 people, 6 who were Asian women. The House Judiciary Committee held the first hearing in 3 decades on discrimination against Asian Americans. Toward the beginning, Republican Representative Chip Roy of Texas said the victims of the Atlanta shooting deserve justice and referenced lynching in his remarks.
There's old sayings in Texas about find all the rope in Texas and get a tall oak tree. We take justice very seriously.
Representative Roy was also concerned that the hearing focused on, quote, the policing of rhetoric in a free society, end quote. Democratic Representative Grace Meng of New York responded to Representative Roy's rhetoric.
Your president and your party and your colleagues can talk about issues with any other country that you want, but you don't have to do it by putting a bullseye on the back of Asian Americans across this country, on our grandparents, on our kids.
Republican Representative Michelle Steele of California and Democratic Representative Katie Porter have introduced a resolution condemning hate crimes committed against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. Meanwhile, Biden cabinet picks are moving. The Senate confirmed William J. Burns as CIA director and Javier Becerra as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Becerra, the former California State Attorney General, will be the first Latino to head HHS. Biden nominated former Florida Senator Bill Nelson to lead NASA. That awaits Senate confirmation. The administration plans to send millions of doses of the AstraZeneca COVID vaccine to Mexico and Canada, the White House said yesterday. The vaccine hasn't been authorized by American regulators yet. Kate, age 20, from Mexico, asked not to use her last name. She said her grandfather recently died from COVID, and she's frustrated many there don't wear masks.
A lot of people, they say, oh, it's almost over. The vaccine is coming. We don't really have to wear masks. They don't think about other people, like my grandpa. My grandpa was really old.
Conservatives continue to criticize Biden's handling of the southern border. The administration says there are now 14,000 migrant children in U.S. custody, but refuses to call the situation a crisis. Finally, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki says Biden does not regret calling Putin a killer for ordering the poisoning of Kremlin critics. Putin yesterday responded that it takes one to know one. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, Get trained to be a citizen journalist and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm speaking with Roger Scholey, retired journalist from the San Diego Union-Tribune and author of six books, including three San Diego Memories volumes and three others on local history. My guest is also president of the Balboa Park Committee of 100 and serves on the boards of the San Diego Architectural Foundation and Friends of San Diego Architecture. That's a lot. Welcome, Roger Scholey. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Nice to be with you, Raina.
Okay, let's begin with your history. I know that you're a third generation San Diegan. You graduated from UC San Diego in 1970 with a history degree, and you've raised your family here. How did you end up as staff writer for the UT for 44 years, and ultimately your involvement in this series?
I was a reporter for the Triton Times at UCSD and was one of the founders in the 60s. And the university does not have any journalism program, so we had to self-teach ourselves how to be reporters and editors and everything else. So that's where I got my training. Then I was also a campus correspondent for the Evening Tribune for several years. And after graduation, I made my way to the UT as a reporter and started in 1974. And I've always been interested in San Diego history. Obviously, I was a history major, so that was part of my profile. And as you know, San Diego schools do very little in the way of history teaching of the local history. You only learn it in third or fourth grade, and you never hear about it, about California or San Diego again.
Right.
So a lot of this is self-learning by San Diegans. And if you're from here, you have more chance of learning about the past through your families. But for, I don't know, 80% of San Diego residents, they were not born here, so they don't know innately what place is about, which explains why we vote the way we do sometimes, how we forget things that happened 20 years ago because we weren't here. And my favorite expression I hear from people is, when I moved here 5 years ago, Sandy was much better than it is today. And of course, you can vote by that 20 times for people who've moved here from one period or another. So in the newspaper, I took a special interest in covering the history of places and people that I came across. And then I started writing stories about San Diego history whenever I could, and then myself, because I wasn't taught it either. Well, when I left the newspaper in March of 2018, as I was walking out the door, Jeff Light, the editor of the Union Tribune, pulled me aside and said, "I have something for you to do." So he told me about this series of books by Pediment in Washington State. They have partnered with historical societies and local newspapers to do dozens and dozens of pictorial histories of their places and people and everything else. So I said, sure, I'd love to do that. So we came out with the first book in 2018 that took San Diego up to 1940. And then in 2019, I did the one from 1940 to 60. And this one that you're talking about today was 1960 to 1980. And then I have one more volume, I think, for saying this particular series, 1980 to 2020. And I said, well, why do you go to 40 years period rather than 20? And the Pediment people said, as you get closer to the present, people don't think of that as history. They think of that as me. And I don't care
right.
about me because I lived through all that.
Right.
So I think that's probably one reason why we're going to pull 40 years together in quite a romp from 1980 to now. And I figured that one chapter was going to be about 2020 itself because of the pandemic. So that's the most interesting year in our lifetimes, I think.
So we are living a fascinating history. Before we talk about the book in particular, with your perspective as a longtime journalist and a history expert, what would you say is the biggest difference that you've seen in San Diego over the years, and the biggest difference in journalism as well, if I could ask?
Of course, the biggest difference is it's grown a lot in my lifetime. I was born in 1948, so San Diego was 500,000 people about then, and now it's 1.3 million just in the city, and the county itself is 2 or 3 million. Mm-hmm. And if you bring in Tijuana, another 1.5 million, that's maybe 5 million people in our region, which is much bigger than it was 50, 75 years ago. So that's the biggest change, I think, physically in the area. The second thing is that San Diego has become a lot more diverse in terms of demographics, with a lot more ethnic variety from a wave of immigrants who've come here for the last 50 years, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. And then as this book told me, as I was trying to find the right pictures with the History Center and the UT helping, was the role of women in San Diego. So we went out of our way to pull out pictures of women doing all sorts of things. Same thing with minority groups, trying to highlight them, giving their due, because history is typically about white male, leaders, and not much about the average person. So this book, these books are about the life of San Diego residents in all manner of speaking. So from arts to work to home life, everything is supposed to be a snapshot, series of snapshots over the last, in this case, 20 years of 1960 to 1980.
So literally the way we look at the world and evaluate it has changed.
Yeah, and then you asked about the role of the media and the newspapers in this period, 1960 to 1980. I would say that in 1960, the news was basically the Union and the Tribune. That was the main source of people's information about San Diego news. And over the following 20 years, the role of TV journalism has grown a lot more significant. They're not as thorough as the newspaper, but obviously, but people get a lot of their news from watching TV. And of course, that's not at all touching on the current period where it's all online and many other sources. But in those days, it was basically news. Most people would take a newspaper. Most families would take San Diego Union and Tribune. And now it's many people don't take the newspaper. They get it online or they read other sources. So that's the big difference. I think the other difference in journalism over my career is that the idea of investigative journalism has become much more important than it used to be. If you go back and read the newspapers of earlier times, there was very little of that sort of thing, and analysis. There were sometimes columnists that got into some background, but the prevalence of investigative journalism was not really very active in San Diego until the 1970s. So starting in that period, when Jerry Warren became the editor in the 70s and was in the 80s, he specialized and urged us to be much more investigative in all realms of the coverage, not just big political scandals, but anything.
That explains a lot. Okay, well, let's talk about the latest book in this series, San Diego Memories 3, A Time of Change, as you mentioned, the 1960s and the 70s. You've told us a little bit about your collaboration with the San Diego History Center and the Union Tribune. Give our listeners more of a look at this volume. What's in it?
Well, there are 7 or 8 chapters, and each one has a certain focus. So let me just give you a sense of what those are. This is typically the categories that their pictorial histories include, but some of them are San Diego centric. For example, we have a military chapter, a maritime chapter that you wouldn't see in other cities. But we also, one thing I suggested we do, which is to lead off the book with activism, basically the political turmoil and craziness of the 60s and 70s. And in the foreword, I talked about that as well, saying that the 60s and 70s is very much like what we've gone through in the last 4 or 5 years during the Trump administration, and a great deal of polarization and street you know, demonstrations and sometimes violence outbursts. You know, it's just been, for those of us who grew up in the 60s, they said, this is just like it was when we were 20 years old. So right. It's been a rerun of historical trends back then. There's also other non-political kinds of things in the book, sports, leisure, public service, transportation. I also wanted to do something on the seedy side of life, which is crime, scandals. We've had a number of terrible disasters in this period that people who lived here know all about. And the final chapter is about arts and culture. So we have there are about 300 pictures that are in the book, and we can talk about how we went about doing that, because it was a lot of fun and a lot of work, though.
How did you go about doing that? Tell us.
Well, I started with a timeline, because I'm a historian, so I believe in looking at history through time and chronologically. So Mary Mati Agudo, the UT archivist, has been keeping a meticulous timeline of San Diego history, starting from the beginning, and she's always updating it with events today and findings from the past that she inserts into her chronology. So I said, well, give me the 1960 to 80 time period. So I went through and I circled all the events and things that seemed to be reminding me of what happened in the news. And then we started looking for pictures along the same lines and tried to categorize all the pictures by these different chapters. And I think we ended up about 600 or 700 candidates. And then Pediment editors pulled out the ones they thought were the most compelling pictures. And that was about done in April last year. And then I went to work to research all the pictures we picked. I didn't want to do that first because I didn't want to research something that wouldn't show up in the book. So luckily I have access to the UT's digital archives back to the beginning. And so I was able to plug in an event or the date of whatever the picture was and find the story that's tied to the picture.
Wow.
Which is very much more revealing than you realize, because the pictures the History Center has does not have any of that sort of information on the picture. It just says, right, seeing, you know, traffic congestion on Torrey Pines Road. Well, I looked up the picture, the story that went with that is all about the congestion and that the fact the freeway was under construction nearby and that would relieve the traffic congestion. So there's lots of examples of that where the picture doesn't say 1,000 words. You have to look up the words to see the real information.
Well, I would think if you change some of the cars and the clothing, the picture might look similar to, say, a current time, but the explanation, the reason, the context is so different, right?
Exactly. Yeah, the details make the story. So I mean, sometimes these picture books that you get are not very revealing substance-wise. They're just a couple of lines about describing something that you can see just by looking at it. So I wanted to make this really a book about an information-packed book. So I hope people actually read the captions, because they're going to learn a lot about San Diego history by reading what is the pictures are all about. So
it sounds like
I could have written a book about the San Diego 1960 to 80. Richard Perrault wrote a series of books for the UT back then, and he got into great detail. But after writing my other books, I began to realize people like pictures, they don't like to read, which is pathetic. But
that's another story, another interview.
That's another story. But I wanted to pack in as much information as possibly could in these captions. And sometimes they went overboard and went to great lengths to check people's names and addresses, names and backgrounds, and even found obituaries of people who died who kind of revealed some information about them that wasn't evident at the time of the story, the picture that was run. And I've just found one mistake somebody sent me, which had to do with the Padres sometimes. So we do make mistakes. I tried my best to avoid them, but we did what we could to check everything out.
It sounds like a fun process overall.
It was.
Now, San Diego is famous for being called America's finest city. Do you have any historical perspective on how that came about? And if any of that is reflected, well, I'm sure it's reflected in the series, but what's the history of that?
Well, the phrase America's Finest City has a very particular origin. That was the decision by the Republican National Committee to pull out the 1972 election or convention from San Diego over a series of scandals going on about that convention. So Pete Wilson was the mayor at the time, and his press assistant, Aldo Boss, a former UT reporter, wrote a speech about the what we would do as San Diego to counteract the bad publicity that came of losing this convention. So they declared America's Finest City Week for the same week of the Republican convention. And that phrase stuck, and it became, we had America's Finest City Week for many years, and the Finest City Marathon and lots of other things. But parenthetically, actually, I should admit this, at that year, I was actually working in Washington, D.C. at the Republican National Committee. So I was on the other end of the news where they decided they had to pull the convention out of San Diego and what went into trying to quickly move it to Miami Beach, which is where the Democrats had their convention as well. So I was, you know, a big booster of San Diego, and I was carrying San Diego's torch in the RNC saying, hey, that's terrible, we should stay in San Diego. And of course they didn't, but it was fun watching it from afar.
Isn't that amazing how the slogan stuck? Yeah. In Memories 3, what is your very favorite picture and caption? What makes it your favorite?
Oh, well, my favorite is on the back cover of it, and it's on, it's on page 159, and it shows two kids at Comic-Con in 1976, and they're both sitting there reading a Howard the Duck comic book, what I love about this picture is it tells several stories. First of all, comics. Second, Comic-Con, which is a San Diego creation.
Right.
And these two boys, one black and one white, sitting there as chums reading this comic book. So if you want something symbolic about San Diego's progress in being a diverse city and a fun city and everything else, this picture says it all. So that's my all-time favorite in this book. And when I came across it, I said, this is fantastic. I tried to find these two kids, but I wasn't able to track them down.
Interesting. It sounds iconic.
Yeah.
Now, the architectural boards and the other committees that you're involved in, do they inspire your work? Do you think you'd be getting involved with the same projects without the involvement in all those boards?
It grew out of my job at the UT for mostly my career was growth and development. And so I was very interested in San Diego's growth and its buildings and planning of San Diego and architecture and everything else. So one feeds the other, you know, and there's a lot of development type pictures I wanted to put in this book, because that's my favorite thing, is how San Diego grew physically. And so I serve on those two groups and the Committee of 100 in Balboa Park, always being mindful of San Diego's architecture and the need to save pieces of the past, because if you don't have them, you don't think about the past. So there's been this book has some of that in here, some historic preservation mentions. And so in the 1960s, that's actually when the whole U.S. became much more interested in historic preservation than it had been in the past. And the federal government passed a law creating the National Register of Historic Places. And San Diego created its historic site board, and other groups like Save Our Heritage Organization were formed at the time. And our group, the Committee of 100 at Balboa Park, also in the 1960s, because San Diego was rushing ahead in the 60s and 70s with growth and development and thousands of people moving here and building new subdivisions all over the place. It also had a very valuable elements from the past to save. And the Gaston Quarter, for example, was the association was founded in the 70s to save those buildings on Fifth Avenue downtown. And some buildings were lost, And we saw pictures of that. Mm-hmm. But others have been saved or restored or reconstructed. So we still have a lot to look to, but we've lost quite a lot of important buildings, including this year, the stadium is being demolished. You know, I mentioned there's a nice pictures of the stadium being built in 1965 to 67, mm-hmm. but the next volume will show the stadium being demolished. You know, that's one of the great crazy things about San Diego is we build something and 50 years later, we throw it away. Horton Plaza Shopping Center is going right through right now. So, this is history in the making. It's an American thing to throw away the past and don't remember it. That's good and bad in some ways.
Yeah, that leads me to, I guess, the question, why does it matter? Why is it so important for us to look back as well as forward?
Well, there's the usual statement that if you forget the past, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, you never repeat the history. It never happens that way. But there's certain things that come up in one time, and then a couple of generations later, we find it up again. I mean, this whole thing of right now we're going through with the Republican Party trying to battle back the QAnon people mm-hmm. Just shows you how dangerous forgetting the past can be. I mean, I was thinking, you know, now we know why Hitler was able to take over Germany with a minority of people, because the vast majority of Germans they didn't take him seriously. Well, this is exactly what we're witnessing today with this whole battle of the QAnon people and the fake news people and all that. They just pick their own facts or create them or invent them. And if the public doesn't educate itself, they're going to be, going to face some totalitarian results in the U.S. Yeah. And the rest of the world, you know, that they were surprised the U.S. came this way. But if you read American history, we've had this sort of thing happen over and over again.
Right.
From the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, all of our mm-hmm. battles have had this sort of conflict between groups, between regions, between mm-hmm. people, between generations. This is nothing new. If you don't read learn the history, you're gonna make the wrong decisions, I think, and when you go to the ballot box. So I wish that we would have. Well, Texas apparently is a very good state for learning, teaching local history, state history, partly because they were separate country for some years in the 1830s mm-hmm. and 40s. But California doesn't take any of that seriously. So there was a lot of talk and action at the state level in California, you know, to make people more aware of diversity and minority groups and their contributions to California. I'm hoping that effort broadens out to the general story of California and San Diego and other localities, because we could use a lot more real knowledge of that personally than we do now.
Yeah, so let's hope history finds its way back into all levels of schooling, yeah. Right? Yeah.
It never was. I mean, actually, it's never been a priority in the sense I'm talking about. So,
okay, good point.
It'd be nice to take that on.
Very good. I've got one last question for you. Tell us just a little bit more about what you're working on now and when we can expect to see it in print.
Okay, well, the plan is this year, which I haven't started yet, to work on the last copy of the last mm-hmm. Entry in the series, San Diego Memories, 1980 to 2020. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take in the same categories as we've had in the past. As I said at the outset, I think one chapter probably will be devoted to the pandemic year, because that is just an amazing thing that happened here and around the country, around the world. So just as we had an activism chapter in the 1960-80 book, I think 2020 will be sort of the opening chapter of the story, because even though it's contemporary, it's going to be something everyone will remember forever, I think.
Right.
So I'm going to go through with Mary and start with the chronology of the last 40 years and start to pick up pictures. Now, the difference between this book and the last ones was the History Center had a wealth of 2 or 3 million images that we could draw from. They've all been cataloged. You could just go on their website and find pictures, and which I did. They don't have virtually anything from 1980 because their collection is mostly Union Tribune negatives and photos. So those were the four pictures in this book and all the other books, to the extent we had them. The new issue, the news book, is going to be totally relying on UT file photos. And I don't have access to them at my home computer yet. I hope I can, because otherwise Mary's going to do all the work finding them. But it's going to make it, it'll be similarly organized by finding the pictures, tracking down the stories that go with the pictures, and then writing the captions to go with them. So I think they'll, if everything goes well, we'll finish this by in time for the holidays this coming year.
I can't wait to see it. I think it will be a fascinating enterprise choosing the cover picture. There's so many choices.
I've been thinking about this. And what is the, what is the one, and in this case, the picture we did in this book was John F. Kennedy at a pre-election rally in San Diego in 1960 during the presidential campaign. We picked that. I said, gee, what happens if Trump gets reelected? This will look kind of strange to have Kennedy on the cover, but it was a time of change. He was a new generation, you know, so that in many ways that was a very good choice for this book. But for the 1980 to 2020, I mean, there's so many possibilities, and it's somewhat inspiring, not a negative thing, but some, because we could have all kinds of pictures on the cover that are kind of scary,
right?
Or we could have something that's in ennobling, you might say,
inspiring or hopeful at least.
Yeah. So I will just kind of, I mean, you could have someone with a shot in the arm or getting a virus,
right.
Specific, but we'll find something will come out. And what happens is Peniman goes through and picks all the pictures and puts them in the layout, and then they come up, they pick several of them as potential cover pictures, and we all weigh in on which ones we think are the best, and then they pick the one because they're in charge.
Well, if you need another vote, let me know.
Okay.
Roger, our time is up. But thank you so much for joining us. It was really a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to talk to you too, Raina.
To contact Roger Scholey, please write him at R.M. Scholey, that's Scholey, at yahoo.com.
Oh, we should also mention how people can get the book, because it isn't available in stores. So they can get it online by going to pediment.com. That's the publisher. And you could write me if you want to get a copy that I can autograph. So you can send me a request as well.
Very good. An autographed copy for your coffee table.
Right.
Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.